please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Crystal from Easton.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. I'm Crystal. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Crystal.
I'm so glad to be here tonight. I've heard a lot of your speakers on tape, and I'm so proud to be here tonight. I thank God for that, and only God, because He gave me another chance at life. Give you a little bit about my history and what it was like and what it's like now. Up until the time that I was 10 years old, I lived in Walnutport, Pennsylvania. I had a mother, a father, two younger brothers, an older sister. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, she lived with us and she helped to raise us while Mom and Dad worked. And we had so much fun. We had a great childhood. There were those nights that Mom and Dad fought, and we thought that that was normal. You know, Mom would be screaming bloody murder. You could hear things being thrown. And we just laid there sometimes at night. My sister and I shared a room, and we just would talk about it, and we let it go. We had a bar in our basement, and Dad would drink on the weekends pretty much from the time after lunch until the time he went to bed. Never appeared drunk. We would be the first ones to run downstairs and want to tap his beer and take a little hit off the top of it. My favorite was Mom's Bloody Marys because I love tomato juice, so I would guzzle those in a heartbeat and never knew that they contained alcohol. And really didn't bother me any. We always had a swimming pool to go to. We had each other, and I never really fit in, so I would isolate down in the basement playing with my toys or watching scary movies in the basement in the dark. That was my thing. The night of June 28, 1978 changed my life forever. We were staying with my grandparents down in Swordsville, New Jersey, for vacation Bible school, and my grandmother never came to pick us up that Friday at noon like she normally did. And the minister called us into the office, all of the Luckenbach children, please come in the office, I need to talk to you. And he said, I have good news and I have bad news. So we wondered and we wanted to know what the good news was, and he said, your father's okay, he's in the hospital. And so then he told us the bad news. He said, your mother was shot and killed this morning, and my life changed. He said, I said, well, what does that mean exactly? He said, she went to see God this morning. She won't be coming home. And we sat there in awe. We looked at each other, and we started to cry. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to react, because that was the first death I ever had to deal with. So we went home, and for the next several weeks, we weren't allowed to watch television. We weren't allowed to look at newspapers. We weren't allowed outside the house. We weren't allowed to do anything. And we stayed in Swordsville, New Jersey. We never went back to Walnutport except to grab our belongings. We got a chance to say goodbye briefly to our friends. Our toys were all gone. Our clothes, half of them were gone. And that's how we lived that summer. It was a nightmare. I instantly started to isolate. I was angry with God. That was a disconnection of my higher power because I couldn't understand how a loving God could do that to four young children. What did I do to deserve this? How could that have happened? I just didn't understand. You know, the whys, the hows, the ifs, the buts. So that summer, we did get to go see my father in the hospital. He was being guarded. He was shackled to the bed. And then the real nightmare started when he got let out and he was going through the trial. And that's when I found out that he wasn't even my biological father. I sat in a courtroom and they said the two children by Barbara's previous marriage are here today. And my sister and I looked around looking for two other children. And then we realized that it was us. And the joke was on us. After that, he went to Bradyford State Penitentiary. And that's how I spent my teenage years, every Saturday and Sunday, going to a state penitentiary to visit him. And I was angry. And I was mad. And I hated him. And I hated God even more. And I hated my family because why did I have to do that when all of my friends were having fun on the weekends and they were playing? and they got to do what they wanted to, and I was behind locked doors visiting somebody who I thought I loved, who did everything for me as a child, who told me now that he didn't do it, and I was angry, and I was mad. And I remember being 13 years old and being invited to a party. And now I was heavy set, I was disconnected, I was lonely, irritable, and discontent. And I was called Moo Moo, and I was the fun of the game. Everybody made fun of me, and what was it like to live with a murderer? And how do you feel? And tell me what it's like in school. And I hated them all. I just wanted to go back home to my house in Stuartsville, or to Walnutport. So when I went to the party that night, I wasn't going to go, because these are the same people that made fun of me. And when I went, they said, here, have something to drink. And I did. And that was the best thing that happened to me at 13. And I thought, wow, this is great stuff. I loved it. I loved the feeling that it gave me, and I loved the feeling that it did to me. It no longer made me fat. It no longer made me ugly. It no longer made me lonely. It made me a new girl. So every chance that I could have to go and be at the parties, I did. And then I found marijuana in my uncle's bedroom, and then I really became a hit at the parties. Can you bring some more of that for us? So I did. And I continued to want to go to every party that I was invited to. And in Stuartsville, New Jersey, there's one bar. It's called The Hideaway, and my girlfriend lived on the farm right behind it, so we knew exactly when the beer distributor was going to come and deliver. So when they would go inside to deliver more beer, we'd steal a case and we'd go back up to her camper that was on the property. And even though it was warm Heineken, we drank it on the weekends when I would go to her house. And then her mother would have us pick warm eggs and make them for breakfast, which I thought was disgusting, but especially after drinking warm Heineken the night before, but that was okay. So then I got older and we started to camp at Jugtown Mountain campsites. And we were allowed to stay there on the weekends because my grandparents had an agreement with them that we could stay there for free if we helped them do all the cleaning of the campsites, bag the ice, and just help out in general. And that was wonderful. That was like the next best thing in my life that happened, because now I was in charge of my brothers because my sister got smart and moved out, and I was left alone to bother them. I became disconnected with my sister because I was extremely angry at her that she now had the freedom and the life. And here I was stuck watching these two little brats, and I was in control of them. But I made up for it because once I got to that campground, and I was about 16 at this point, and then we started to party at night with the boys, and I loved that. I ran ragged. I would put my brothers in the camper at night, and I would take off to every party that was in the campsite with the campground owner's kids. They were all, there was one girl, and the rest of them were all boys. And then I found my true love at each and every campsite. And I thought that was great, and I did that for a couple years in a row. And I was very sad when the winter time came because that meant camping was over, so I started to isolate again. I was just so lonely inside. I didn't have a purpose. I didn't have a life. Like, the only thing that gave me a purpose of life was drinking, because I was happy then. So I would be going out with all these different guys, and they made me happy. So I thought we would run around, and we would party, and we would have fun, and we'd hang out at the bowling alley, and we would do crazy, stupid shit, like go into a bowling event in the back of my car, drinking any kind of shot that you could possibly think of, slow gin fizz, drinking a bottle of that the night before my cheerleading competition with my white satin jacket, and I threw up all over it. And I was up all night trying to get that out of my jacket. Stupid, stupid stuff. And all that partying and all that craziness went on until I got to be about 18 and a half, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. Like, I was drinking all the time. You know, my grades were just going down the crapper, and I wanted it to end. So when I worked at Burger King, there was a nerdy guy there, and he asked me on a couple dates, and I went, and then he asked me to marry him. And he promised me the white picket fence and the dog and the kids. And I thought, okay, great. I'm going to have a wonderful life. And he wasn't a partier. So I said, yes. And I got married when I was 19. And we had that great little house. And we had a picket fence. Not really. It was a chain link. And then we had the kids. And I was empty. And I even wrote a letter. I was sitting, he was sitting next to me, and I said, I have never felt so alone in my whole life. And I meant it. I didn't drink when I was married, maybe a wine cooler here or there, but I was extremely empty. And I knew what was missing. When I got divorced, at 13 years was over, that marriage was gone, I ran right to the bar, and I had that first drink, and I knew I was back home. I loved it, I needed it, I wanted it. And it was like I never stopped at all. That first night I came home drunker than a skunk, in a blackout, and I woke up the next morning and I was like, I gotta meet my friends again tonight. And every single night, from that night on, I was in a bar room. But the one thing that I forgot over time was, oh, and I met a guy that night, that first night in the bar, and he was going to teach me how to shoot pool, throw darts and quoits. And that procession continued. I got divorced that year. I left him in June when I graduated with my RN degree. And I knew that that was going to be the end. Once I graduated with that nursing degree, I didn't need him to support me anymore. I could make it on my own. So I left in June, and December we were divorced. But that guy that I met the first night in the bar, we were ended up living together. And that was a nightmare. Because we did. We drank every single night. I didn't realize the bars were open on holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. And that whole summer was just like a big blur. It went by so quick. I forgot that I had two small children. The kids were young. And I forgot that they were there. Occasionally I would keep them overnight or take them out to dinner, buy them a pizza and some french fries, and then I would rush them back to their dad. Because the people at the bar started to need me. Because now all of a sudden I was a really good pool shot and I became the captain of the league. And the quait team needed me because I was now on that. The dart team needed me because I was on that. And all these people needed me because I was important. The guys started paying attention to me. I liked that. I was important once again. And I learned how to drink beer, which I hated. And they told me if I wanted to be hanging with the boys, I needed to be one of the boys. So they taught me how to drink beer for shot. And I did that. And I did it pretty good. Because I could drink any of the guys under the table. And I thought that was an accomplishment. And I did that for 2 years. And then he annoyed me. And I bought a house, and he moved in with me, and he quit his job that first night that I moved into the house. And I said, get out. And then that night I met the man of my dreams in the bar. Here he came. He was with a white beater on, he had dirty jeans, he had work boots, and he had a bandana around his head, and I thought, okay, yep, that's what I need in my life. And I did for 16 years. He was 24, I was 34. And my friends would say, how's the paper boy? And I said, he's doing just fine. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that running around, having a good time, meeting all his friends. He taught me how to salmon fish on Lake Ontario, taught me how to pull a gun, which I was scared of since that's how Mom died. But he taught me that. He gave me that courage to do that. And I felt like I was finding myself all over again because he gave me that independence and he gave me that freedom to do what I wanted to do. So I thought, but I did it only with him. I became involved and confined in a relationship. I didn't have friends anymore. I didn't go anywhere without him. I would work my day shift job. I didn't drink on the job. But come 7:16, I was sitting on my bar stool. And I proceeded to drink until the bars closed at 2 o'clock. I'd go home and sleep for a couple of hours. And then I'd wake up all hungover and go into work in my nice little nursing dressing uniform. And I didn't really care at that point if I was taking care of your mother or your grandmother or your family member. Being hungover, not clearly thinking, it didn't matter to me that my thought processes were not properly and clear, that I may be hurting somebody. And I was in a step-down ICU ward at this point, so I needed to be critically thinking. I didn't care. I made some really poor decisions. But to me at the time, they were the great decisions that I made. And I still didn't care about my children because I still had those same tendencies to pick them up and drop them off. I was missing their whole childhood. I didn't realize that my daughter was starting to be a young lady and that she needed her mother. My ex-husband got remarried and I thought that was great that she had a mother figure. But yet I didn't realize inside she was dying and needed her mother. I didn't realize that all these changes were going on. And I was totally oblivious to what was happening around me. I didn't realize that I was beginning to suffer and that my job was trying to get rid of me because I was not standing up to what I should be. So after 17 years at Warren Hospital, they kindly asked me to leave my position, and I did. And I walked right into another position of where I had been working part-time. So then I walked into an adult cardiology office because I thought that would be a great idea for somebody who drank constantly. And I did that, and that was very difficult for someone who's constantly hungover and not thinking straight. But I did that anyway, and that was really a downfall also. My boyfriend at the time, that 16-year relationship gentleman, he worked out of town Monday through Friday, and he was home for the weekends. So I thought it would be a great idea that because I always had that problem of being lonely and didn't like that, that it would be okay to bring a guy home, a different guy every night, to keep me company and be there with me. So that's what I did. And I didn't see a problem with that. And then on the weekends, I would be the happy little girlfriend. And I continued that lifestyle for about 3 years. And every night, though, going to the bar. Never stayed home, always at the bar doing something different. And I had to be careful which bars that I went to because there would be different people at different bars that knew who I was and who I was with. So I had to kind of remember that and collaborate that into everything. And that continued for quite a while. On May 18th of 1997 was probably one of the toughest days of my life. I saw that gentleman stumbling around the house. He didn't know where he was going or what he was doing. And he was also a drinker. And I was sicker than a dog, which I had been for some time. Let me rewind just a minute. I had been really sick for about a year before that. I started to have pancreatitis. And as a nurse, I knew what was going on, but I didn't want to know what was going on. I knew my body was starting to shut down. I couldn't eat anymore. I also had a history of bulimia. So I was 119 pounds soaking wet. I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink water. I couldn't drink protein shakes. But I could manage to keep down the vodka. And then I couldn't feed myself, and I couldn't bathe myself, and I couldn't walk without a walker because I was beginning to get wet brain syndrome. And all of my tests and studies showed that. I didn't leave the house. I couldn't go out. I couldn't drive anymore. My family pretty much disowned me except for my youngest daughter. And that's the way that I lived my life. I slept on a couch because I couldn't go up to the shower. He'd help me wash up in the back bathroom. And that is what I did. I laid on the couch. I had a bucket next to the couch where I would throw up in constantly. And then it turned into blood that I was throwing up. So not only would I be admitted to the hospital every other week for an IV transfusion, but then I started to have blood transfusions. But the only thing I could manage to lift my lips and keep down was my vodka. And I had switched from Yukon Jack to vodka because I thought that that would be a much better choice, just like it says in the big book. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic. I just needed to change it up. So I did that. So on May 18th, I had enough smarts to be able to pick up my phone and dial 911. And they took him to the hospital, and they were supposed to take him to the closest hospital to our home. The next morning, I called the hospital, and they had no recollection of him. And it had to be the next morning because I blacked out from drinking all that vodka that I had, and I had no idea where he was. And at first, I didn't care because he was so controlling. But I thought it was my place to try to find him. I was afraid to call his mother. And so we finally found him. He was in an intensive care unit at the closest hospital to our house because he coded on the way there. But they revived him, and he was there in the intensive care unit, and he was going to go to rehab. And he would not be coming home unless I got sober as well. And I had a choice to make because my family had begged me for years to get sober, and I wanted no part of that, absolutely no part of it. I didn't know how to live without my alcohol. I didn't want to live without my alcohol. All I wanted to do every night was, my foxhole prayer was, please, dear God, do not let me wake up tomorrow morning because my life is over and I can't do this anymore. And when I would wake up the next morning and I was still here, all I could think was, you know, I have to do this all over again today, and hopefully I can drink enough to put me out of my misery today. So when I got the news that he wasn't coming home, I thought, okay, fine. And I drank for 2 more weeks. June 6, 2017, I put the bottle down. And I had had hallucinations prior to that. So bad that some nights I did not want to close my eyes. I was horrific. I had sweats. I was a miserable, miserable person. I couldn't stand it. The hallucinations were horrific. And I do not wish on anybody that you ever go through the trying to get sober at home alone. You should definitely be somewhere where somebody is monitoring you. However, I was 2 weeks sober when they decided to put me in a rehab. And because I was using the walker and so ill, they put me in Valley Forge because that was supposed to be the best for my condition. When I got there, everything was downstairs. They had no elevator. So they wouldn't let me go to any of the speeches or any of the group sessions. I was not given a big book. Nobody spoke to me. No counselor saw me. That was for 4 days. And I finally said, okay, now I colored as much as I possibly can. I drank as much coffee as I possibly can, and I've learned how to smoke my brains out. And I'm not getting anything out of this. So maybe I should go back home, where I can probably do all these same things at home. So they finally sent a counselor downstairs and said, okay, will you go to an outpatient rehab? And I said, well, if it's going to help me, I would love to, because that's what I'm here for, I thought. So I went to an outpatient rehab, and I did that 3 days a week. And I was only supposed to do it for like 6 weeks. And at 3 months, they said, you know, Crystal, we really need to get you out of here because your insurance company's really giving us a hard time. And I said, I don't want to go. So they had to let me go. And I was scared about that. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to be out in the real world all alone. But I had already started going to AA. And I had been going to AA 3 months in 2016. I went, and all I did was sit in a chair, drink my coffee, and avoid everything that anybody said to me or gave me their numbers. I throw them away when I left. I had no tools. I had no sponsor. I had no big book. So when I went back in the beginning of July, I wanted to be sober. I wanted a new life. When I walked in that first Monday morning meeting and everybody said to me, we're glad you made it back. Welcome home. And I felt like I was home. I felt that warmth and that love surround me. And because I was still using the walker, they'd bring me coffee. They made me comfortable. I no longer ran to the bathroom when somebody handed me something to read. I got numbers, and because I still was coming out of wet brain, I have to write down Patty with the glasses, with the brown short curly hair, or Sue with the blonde hair and blue eyes, just so I could associate who was who. And I was afraid that it was a cult when I first came in. I didn't know what to expect. I thought they sucked you right in here. I had no idea that the chairperson didn't go to college to learn how to do that, which is what I thought. But you all taught me. I saw the happiness and joy and the serenity on everybody's face. And I wanted that peace because I hadn't ever had that. I heard and saw God, and I thought, oh no, I can't do this. He's the first person I had a resentment in my whole life against. How's that going to happen to somebody like me? And how can you save a wretch like me? And they said, it'll happen. Just don't leave before the miracle happens. Stick around. We'll show you how. Just be patient. Don't leave before the miracle happens. And I'm like, where are all these sayings coming from? I saw all of them hanging on the windowsill. Time takes time. Easy does it. One day at a time. And I'm like, what is all this crap? And they said, talk about it. Just stay and listen. I thought, okay, stay and listen. And I kept coming back because I wanted to know what it meant. Because I'm curious and I'm nosy. So I kept coming back. And I think I did 380 meetings in 90 days because I did like 3 meetings a day. I would go whenever somebody asked me if they could pick me up because I still couldn't drive. And I did Zoom meetings. I did phone meetings. I found a phone meeting that was on at 10 p.m. and then also at midnight. Just like Zoom, but you don't see them. You can just listen in, and if you want to share, you can share. And those saved my life. Listening to people talk about their experience, strength, and hope. I needed to hear that. I needed to hear how it worked on somebody else. Because I can read the big book all I want. I can read how it demoralized me and how I had the phenomenon of craving that I needed that next drink and that I had the allergy. But until I heard how I was going to stay sober and get sober and find out how to do that, it meant nothing to me. And I needed to hear it from all of you guys. I needed to listen to your stories. I needed to experience all of the heartache and to bring it down and go through it with my sponsor. I couldn't even find a sponsor for the first year and a half that would stick with me, and I thought, I'm not even worthy enough to be in AA. How does that happen? And they said, the right person will come along. Just don't leave before the miracle happens. I said, how long does that happen? When does that happen? How long do I have to wait? They said, time takes time. Time takes time. And I hated that. What do my sponsors hate when I tell them that now? But it works. And I started working with a sponsor, and by that time I had already listened for a year and a half. I didn't stop me from going to meetings. I went to meetings every single day, a couple times a day, speaker meetings, big book meetings, tradition meetings, you name it, I was there. Living sober meetings, meat and potatoes, how it worked. I listened to how all of you got that serenity. And on the third step, my oldest daughter didn't talk to me for 3 years. On the day that I was working my third step, she texted me and said, Mom, I would really like to come over and talk to you today. You want to talk about the promises coming true? I never thought they'd come true in my life. My 16-year relationship ended. And at this point, I had started to get some tools in my belt and know how to use them. That you guys taught me that when situations baffle me, I know how to handle them. And I picked up the phone in one hand and the landline in the other, and I kept looking at my keys. And my youngest daughter, who has been my rock and my salvation, who helped to get me into a rehab, said to me, Mom, don't do it. He's not worth it. You've come a long way, and let's continue to work this journey together. And thank God that I did, because they all talked me down off the beam. They got me back and got my feet planted on the ground and kept me moving forward. I went and talked about it at meetings, and I know they were sick of hearing me, but I was only 2 years sober, and I still didn't have that. They were sick of hearing it, and they said, it'll get better. It will get better. It is probably going to be the best thing that ever happened to you one day, and you're going to look back and see that. And honest to God, today it is the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I had never been alone. I had never been independent on my whole life. It was always being with my grandparents raising me, and then jumping right into a marriage, then jumping right into the guy from the bar, to the next guy from the bar. I didn't even know who the heck I was. I didn't know who Crystal was until I was 50 years old. And I love me. My sponsor said to me, you need to look yourself in the mirror and tell yourself you love you. I said, yeah, right. She said, it'll happen. You're going to continue working steps. And you will do that. She said, look at everything that life has given you. You know who you are. You've got... I am on disability, but I started working at Giant Food Store because I had surrendered my nursing license 5 years ago when I was so sick, because there's no way that I could have taken care of a patient, let alone myself. And I didn't know, because I was so sick, that I could have just put my nursing license in hiatus, because at that point I was also accused of being a drunken, boozing nurse to a special needs child. And I thought, I'm not going to have them take my nursing license away from me. There's no way. And the deposition went through, and I was doing that for 18 hours one day, and it was presented to a judge after I did my deposition and her deposition, the mom's deposition. And the judge said to me, I'm going to throw this out, because this is a bunch of horse crap. Everything that you did, that you documented, it's all right here in black and white. And it was one of the best days of my life, but that doesn't exist. But there's no way that I could retaliate. So I left it go. My sponsor said, let it go. You're a better person than that. That doesn't matter. But who you are now, people are going to look at what you've done and who you are now. You don't need that. She said, do you ever think you'll go back into nursing? And I said, no. I said, there's just no way. I will never. that part of my life is over. I had gone to a meeting in Bath, Pennsylvania in November of last year, and there were two women speaking there, and I heard them share their experience, strength, and hope. And they were nurses, and they talked about how they had lost their licenses and got them back. That gave me the hope and the courage that someday there might be a chance for me. And I left that night, and I went home, and I started to search how to do that. What would be the next step for this person to start working on that? And the next day, I worked with my sponsor, and we petitioned to the State Board of Nursing. And they accepted my proposal. And so since from November of last year until the beginning of September, I have gone to cognitive evaluation therapists. I have gone to Living Green Rehab. I have had all kinds of evaluations and ups and downs and in and outs and waiting. And then that day, that first Thursday of September, my nursing license was reinstated. And I never thought in a million years that that would happen. This program continues to unravel miracles in my life. I broke my back July 1st, and it was a miracle because when that happened, I was able to be home and to be on top of that nursing license. I was able to call the last person who I needed to get the records from, and I was thankful. There was nothing I could do. My back was already broken, and I was extremely thankful to be home. I was able to get things done around my house that hadn't been done. I was able to go to meetings. I was able to be on Zoom more meetings. I was able to connect with my higher power a little bit more. One of the blessings of this program also has been that after I got to work the 12th step, that my sponsor said, you're now allowed to go out and work with others. And I said, that's not going to happen. That can't happen to me. I'm not qualified for that position. She said, you most certainly are. You help people every day. You work with others. You know how to handle situations that baffle you. You need to pass on to the next sick and suffering alcoholic what you do every day, Crystal, that you show people how this program works, that where you were 5 years ago and where you are today, that you need to continue to let that path grow. And a young lady came up to me and said, will you be my sponsor? And I said, absolutely. And then I've gotten two other sponsees. But that first person that asked me, we spent time in Akron, Ohio this year at Founders Day. It was one of the best times I've had going out there to where it all first began. And we did so much in 3 days. We drove out ourselves. So we went to the Mayflower Hotel where that phone call was made. We went to the gravesite. We went to the home where when you go there, they say, welcome home. And you know that you're there. Kneeling at the bedside saying the third step prayer. Chilly. 10,000 people in a stadium. If you've never gotten a chance to go to Founders Day. It's a beautiful thing. Just being there when they call, whether it be a silly question or anything else, I always tell them there is no silly question. If you have one, I'm here for you. I'm here night or day. Because I was always needing something when I was young in sobriety, and my sponsor was always there. There's never a dumb question as far as I'm concerned. When it relates to this program. If I would have thought that when I came in here, I would have walked away. If you would have told me what to do when I walked in the room of AA, I would have left. The fact that it's mere suggested and that that's what you give me, your experience, strength, and your hope, and your suggestions, and nothing is required of me, that's what kept me coming back. That I'm not told what to do. I just recently became a GSR for my Zoom group. and I love it. I'm loving that I'm already getting to get involved and learning more about this program, because I just need to have that more experience. It's time for me to get more involved and see what else is out there. I'm a curious person, and I like to learn. So I've been learning more about the concepts. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be going, Wednesday night, I'm going to be going to find out about the New Year's Eve party. These are the things that I like to do, to experience, to give somebody else more fun and to experience what our AA is really all about. I love what this program has given me. I like to be able to wake up and look myself in the mirror every morning and say, you know what, girl? It's not so bad. You've come a long way, baby, and for that I'm proud. When I celebrated my 5 years recently, my daughter gave me my coin. And when she did, she said, you know, Mom, I never thought that I would be standing here today giving you your coin. Because number one, I never thought that you'd be here. And number two, I'm so proud that I'm the one giving it to you, because it was a long struggle to get you here. She said, I'll never forget the day that I took you to intake. She said, trying to get me up the steps with a walker. She said, I wanted to kill you. And she said, while we were waiting, because they were delayed, I kept saying, I'm leaving, I'm out of here. And she said, you won't go nowhere and you'll like it. And I couldn't be more blessed. She's just given me a grandchild, my first grandchild, 3 months ago. And she said, I honestly believe that God has waited for him to show up until you are in your right mind and that you were taken care of so that you could enjoy him and he'll never see his grandmother as a drunk. And I truly believe that. My oldest daughter, we finally have a relationship. She calls me now to ask me questions and to see my opinion. That's only this program that has given that to me. My sister and I got together 3 years ago to finally talk. I just spent this last weekend in Wildwood with her. Beyond my wildest dreams, this program has shown me what love and life is all about. And if one thing that I can give to you guys, or say to you guys, that this program has given me is hope and courage. I love all of you guys for being here tonight, and thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.